ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT Radio, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about how a meat-based diet is harmful to the environment and to animals as well.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about animals, or you're concerned about the environment, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Jonathan Balcom, a biologist and expert on animal behavior and the author of several books on animal behavior. He was also senior research scientist with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
Wild Earth Guardians reports that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will propose to list six West Texas aquatic invertebrates as endangered under the Endangered Species Act and propose critical habitat designations for all six species. The six species are the phantom cave snail, the phantom spring snail, the diminutive amphipod, the diamond Y spring snail, the Gonzales spring snail, and the Pecos amphipod. According to Mark Salvo, the Wildlife Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians, the thirst for water in the American West has taken a heavy toll on freshwater springs, which are critical habitat for fish, wildlife, and plants. Protecting these animals will help conserve spring systems in West Texas for dependent species and human communities. The current range for the phantom cave snail, the phantom spring snail, and the diminutive amphipod is limited to spring outflows in the San Solomon Spring system near Balmoray in Reeves and Jeff Davis counties. The diamond Weiss spring snails, Gonzales spring snail, and the Pecos amphipod are restricted to spring outflow areas within the diamond Weiss spring system north of Fort Stockton in Pecos County. All six species are threatened by reduced spring flow, modification of spring channels, and water quality changes and contamination at the two spring complexes where they occur. In fact, spring flow at the San Solomon Springs has been maintained by a pump system since 2000 to support species conservation. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is concerned that the risk of extirpation of the three invertebrates at that spring continues to be extremely high for the potential for pump failure, which has occurred in the past. Five of these species were candidates for listing under the ESA, and among more than 800 species covered in the Wild Earth Guardian Species Settlement Agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service announced in 2011. All five candidates have waited for more than 20 years for proposed listing.
Late last month, in an internal newsletter to its employees, the USDA suggested, hidden in the middle of the newsletter, that it would be a good thing if the employees endorsed meatless Mondays in the cafeteria. This immediately was met with severe negative reactions from those in the pockets of the meat industry. Representative Steve King of Iowa called the recommendation heresy and pledged to have double ribeye Mondays instead. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa said that, "I will eat more meat on Monday to compensate for the USDA suggestion." And Senator John Cornyn of Texas proudly posted a photo to his Facebook page showing a smorgasbord of animal flesh that his colleagues were preparing to scarf down as a protest against the USDA. A spokesman for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association called the USDA memo a slap in the face of the people who every day are working to make sure that we have food on the table to say don't eat their product once a week. Less than 2 days later, the USDA removed their newsletter from their website and said that it was a mistake and it was posted without proper approval and that they were sorry. And in a statement released, the USDA meekly announced that it does not endorse Meatless Monday. If this is their reaction to an unofficial, internal, non-binding suggestion that in the midst of an agricultural emergency, its employees forego meat for just 1 day per week, we're in serious trouble. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Jonathan Balcom, author of Pleasurable Kingdom and The Exultant Ark, a pictorial tour of animal pleasure. That's coming up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio, Jonathan Balcom. Thanks for being with us, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, can we start off by having you tell our listeners how you got involved in animal issues?
Sure. Well, if there's a gene for interested in animals, I was born with it because from my very earliest memories, I was captivated by all animal life. According to my mother, trips to the zoo were the highlight of my life starting around age two or three. And that fascination for animals never left me. It was also accompanied by a deep concern. I would always go out of my way to avoid stepping on an insect and removing an earthworm after the rain from the sidewalk and this sort of thing. And so that combination of fascination and concern, probably not surprisingly, led to a career in animal protection. It also carried me through 10 years of biology education at three different universities, which was sometimes trying, but also very rewarding. So I've never regretted making a career about studying animals and working to make the world better for them.
And at what point did you go vegan, and what triggered that?
I decided to take a year off university when I was an undergrad back in 1984 and took a three-month trip, sojourn to India. Ended up being a bit of a spiritual awakening for me. But I decided before I left to stop, to go vegetarian, which is something I'd been thinking about for a long time. And then a few years later, 1989, I had read enough and seen enough information about the treatment of animals in the dairy industry and chickens in egg production that I no longer wanted to support that. And so that's when I stopped purchasing eggs and milk. Removing cheese from my diet took a bit longer. I didn't buy cheese, but I would partake sometimes in restaurants and such. So, you know, it was a gradual progression for me from vegetarianism to veganism. But I suppose I've been solidly vegan for 15 years or so now.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, your experiences. You said, you know, you had this great respect and interest in animals, and you went on to study biology. And, you know, and I'm in the biology department here at UTEP. And one thing that always is hard is when the teaching labs, a lot of them involve looking at dead organisms or preserved organisms, and some of them even, you know, work on animals. How did that affect you as a student?
It was a struggle. There were incidents that I faced as a biology student that were deeply troubling to me, and I write a bit about those in my book Second Nature. And it wasn't until I was well into being a graduate student that I really became more active. As a PhD student leading labs, I actually campaigned to try to end the use of fetal pigs in the dissections there. One could just go to the back of the bookstore and purchase their fetal pig in a pouch, in a plastic pouch. And I informed my students about the issue, and they had the option to dissect a fetal pig or use alternatives, and a good number of my students opted for the alternative. But, of course, in the other classes, hardly anyone would do that because they weren't really given that option. And students are strongly compelled to do what they feel the school wants them to do and thinks they should do. They don't like to rock the boat when they're going to be getting a grade. So that's, you know, one of the sort of dynamics that makes that sort of change difficult to implement. It really, I feel like it needs to begin from the instructor, from the curriculum, from the school itself. So anyway, overall, you know, it was trying at times, but like I said before, I've never regretted it because my biology education has allowed me to be a much more forceful and effective advocate for animals in my career.
Well, that's one thing I was going to say. A lot of times this is when people realize just how similar we are to other animals. You know, they start looking at their fetal pig and realizing, hey, this little fetal pig has, you know, all the same organ systems as we have, and then start to hopefully think the same way. What would it be like if, you know, we were doing this kind of thing on humans, which, of course, people do on cadavers. And I don't know. I think in some ways it does help open students' eyes to the similarity between us and other animals,
you know,
although
I
hate to see it happen.
It did for me, too. I had very similar experiences when I was in graduate school in psychology at the University of Tennessee and reading all the research done on chimpanzees and other primates. I realized how similar they were to us, even though those experiments, you know, it's hard to condone.
Yeah, I mean, these are all good points, and I saw that, too, happening in my classes, students sort of really seeing firsthand just how similar all the similarities there are among vertebrates and, say, pigs and humans, for instance. I think perhaps one of the best ways around that sort of dilemma, that paradox, is to have situations where students can dissect animals, but they're what are called ethically sourced animals. For example, a vet student I know in Norway, she was in the Norwegian vet school and had to dissect an animal, and the typical thing was to give them a sheep or a pig or something who had been deliberately killed for the purpose of the dissection. She wanted to have no part of that.
Yeah.
And so she gained permission to call local farmers and have them inform her if and when an animal was found dead in the field, and within 2 days there were two calls about sheep who had died in the fields. And so she got one of them and worked on that animal. So she was able to have that kind of really firsthand experience with an animal cadaver without having the deliberate killing of the animal that was so ethically troubling to her.
Well, haven't we come far enough that computer models and other techniques are even better than working with dead animals?
In some ways, they are better. They, of course, can provide tests. They can link physiology with histology, you know, pictures of cellular level, and link that up to the organ that you're looking at. Function, you can see streaming videos and animations. And so in terms of integrating different types of information, they're great. Nonetheless, I can sound like a traditional biologist and say, you know, there's no replacing an actual animal body, once living animal body in the tissues. For me, it's all about the origins and the source and the context. These things are never talked about. The students don't know where the animals came from. I would like to see a limited use of cadavers, but that the cadavers be ethically sourced. That, to me, would be the way forward. The way we do it now is just not acceptable in my books.
Your books deal with animals seeking pleasure, and this seems to be something new in the research. How have your books been received by the scientific community?
Limited reception. The few negative reviews I've had of my two books on pleasure have come from academic circles, which is not to say that all of the academic reviews have been negative. There have been some very positive ones, but the few that stand out as being cynical and critical were from sort of my colleagues, in the sense of fellow biologists, fellow ethologists and evolutionary biologists. And the types of arguments being made are the usual sort of staid, behavioristic type positions where, you know, we can never know, you know, feelings do not a science make is the title of one negative review that I had. We can never know for sure that they feel this way, so it's really not scientifically rigorous to go out and say animals can feel pleasure. That sort of thing. So, yeah, that's a bit disappointing to see that kind of thing, but, you know, I don't rest my feelings about my books on the opinions of a few scientists who prefer to live in the dark ages of how we view animals and their capacities. Ironically, you know, some of those negative reviews come from people who've made very important contributions to animal experience, to our sort of appreciation that animals are individuals with preferences and that sort of thing. So there's some irony there. But anyway, I'm very proud and pleased and happy to have been sort of the leader, if you like, the flag bearer of thinking about animal pleasure. It's just amazing how neglected it's been. And while scientists, as far as I can tell to date, have largely ignored my own work, you know, I write mainly for the lay audience, for non-scientific readers, and I'm happy to do that. That's to me, that's more important even than reaching my scientific colleagues.
Can you give us a few examples of animals that pleasure that you go through in your book, and give our listeners just an impression of what kind of behaviors that you witness that would indicate that these animals are indeed deriving pleasure from their behaviors?
Sure. Let me give you some examples kind of relating to touch. And tickled rats, they have a laughing type response. They utter these 50 kilohertz chirps way above our hearing. We can use special equipment to hear them. And they show activity in their brains that are the same types of areas of the brain are active that are active when we're laughing at being tickled. And they run to the hand to be tickled, whereas they come to the hand much slower for a petting session. So there's a series of fascinating studies published in scholarly journals about that, about sort of tickling and laughter, the origins of human laughter, and laughter-like responses in rats. I call them mirthful responses. Fishes will line up to wait their turn to be serviced, to be given a spa treatment on coral reefs and some other habitats. These are fish cleaning stations. It's a well-known mutualism in marine systems. Mm-hmm. And while there are certainly adaptive bases for this, you know, it's good to have parasites and algae removed from your scales if you're a fish. I doubt very much that the fishes are thinking about adaptive benefits. They probably do this because it feels very nice instead of spa treatment. And the cleaner fish get a little bit of nutrients. So it's a mutualism. And then sort of this example actually is a similar type of thing on land where warthogs will flop down in front of colonies of banded mongooses. And the mongooses will swarm over the warthog and pluck away, again, removing parasites and sloughing skin and the like, probably getting a little bit of nutrients, and the warthog seems to just blissfully enjoy the spa treatment. So the pleasure of touch is a very important source of pleasure in these kinds of mutualisms. And so those are just three very quick examples, but I give examples in my books from sex, food. Food, of course, is absolutely indispensable. You know, if you don't get food, you die. So perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised that food is that we're very highly motivated to get food and that it's really enjoyable to consume it, to taste it, to fill our bellies with it. And I like the example of fruit as an illustration of that, because fruit attract animals to the tree where they remove the seeds and take them somewhere else, hopefully, where they'll germinate without competing for the parent plant for light and water and nutrients. And it's all about attraction. It's all about reward, bright colors, nice smell, delicious taste, and a big nutritional reward. It's a beautiful co-evolutionary bargain struck between plants and animals, and it's all mediated by pleasure.
You know, another example I remember you mentioning somewhere was thrill-seeking. I believe it was orangutans' version of bungee jumping.
That's right. They do this snag-riding type of behavior that's been observed in the wild where they will... They have a really good eye for vines and for trees that are different stages of decomposition, and they'll grab onto one. And these forests they live in are so dense and thick that they can sort of plan their ride down, and as the tree bends or even breaks, they can reach out and grab another vine. And it's thought to be sort of a thrilling type of thing, kind of analogous to us going to the fair and taking a roller coaster ride.
Too bad their forests are being lost at devastating rates right now due to consumption of palm oil and things like that. But I hope that orangutans in the wild are deriving some pleasure from those behaviors. You know, that's one thing that I always find interesting is that most people, you know, and even scientists, I'm sure, would agree that their pets and companion animals experience pleasure. So it's always so interesting to me that there's such resistance from the scientific community to admit, if you want to say, or to recognize that animals have these behaviors that, like you say, have extreme evolutionary value.
Yeah, I often think a scientist is going to be quite comfortable to talk about their dog's emotional lives when they've removed their white coat and they're having a beer at the bar later. It's just that the strictures of peer review and scientific discourse are old traditions, and I think they do tend to filter out some of the progressive ideas that might otherwise enter the discourse. I mean, peer review and the scholarly exchange of information is absolutely vital and very important that we have filters that sort of screen out really outrageous or poorly supported ideas. But nonetheless, by the same token, they also can, like I say, exclude certain types of thinking and language that might actually move things forward at a faster rate. So it's a mixed blessing.
I was fortunate to hear one of your talks at the Animal Rights 2012 conference. The room was extremely crowded, so I didn't have a very good view of the screen. But one of the interesting things that you talked about was how animals like us sometimes pay for sex. Can you tell us about roosters and grasshoppers?
Sure. In the case of roosters, chickens have a vocabulary of a variety of calls, 30 or more, and one call is made by roosters, which is essentially directed at hens. And if a rooster finds, say, a grasshopper in the grass and there's a hen nearby, he'll make this call, and she knows the call. She knows it's directed at her, so she'll come running, and he'll point out the morsel, and if she finds it, well, he's probably buying credit for some future trade-off, such as maybe a mating opportunity next week. But sometimes it gets a little Machiavellian. He may make the call deceptively. There's nothing there, and he knows there's nothing there, and that hen's nearby, but she's far enough away she won't notice that there's nothing there. So let me make this call, and she comes running, and she finds nothing, and maybe she'll conclude that the grasshopper jumped away. So it's an example of a deception that hinges on roosters, most roosters being honest most of the time. Hens will soon know if a rooster is continually making calls that don't result in any treats. So it doesn't pay to be a liar too often. So it's an example of sort of give-and-take trade-offs, paying your way, earning credit, keeping accounts, recognizing individuals over long periods. I mean, this is pretty complex cognitive stuff going on. Another study I'll just mention in passing that's relevant is a study of monkeys. I think they were macaques. Found that they would trade in bottles of juice, which they enjoy to drink, frugivores. They would trade in bottles of juice for the opportunity to look at the hindquarters, photos of the hindquarters of female monkeys. So it was almost kind of like a pornography type of effect that they were latching onto.
So tell us a little bit more about some of your other books, because you've written several.
Well, I've written two books that really focus on pleasure, Pleasurable Kingdom and The Exultant Arc, which came out last year, which is a pictorial treatment of the subject. And then my other book, Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals, is a more broad brush view of mostly recent scientific discoveries that relate to animals' experience, animals as being individuals, as having biographies, as having emotions and feelings, and to be virtuous, their way they communicate. There's many facets of animals' lives that are really interesting, and the science now is bringing to light things that we would have thought were just fantasy just a generation or two ago, and that really speaks to a bit of a renaissance or a revolution, if you like, in scientific thinking about animals. For the first half of the last century, as I'm sure Liz well knows, there was a taboo on asking questions about animal minds or whether animals would think or feel, and really for that reason it was sort of just the default view that they didn't have these capacities. Again, this is when the white coats are on before they go to the bar. And then that's changed. In the 1970s, Donald Griffin, an American biologist, started writing books about animal thinking, animal minds, and that, I think, did a lot to open up science to new ways of thinking and to get out of this old behavioristic view. And at the same time, the publication of Animal Liberation by Peter Singer has brought about a sort of the beginnings of a social revolution in our views of animals. And I think the combination of those two events has had a lot to do with why we are sitting here today talking about laughter in rats and, you know, pornography in monkeys and things that just wouldn't have been thought about before.
You've said that the 21st century will be called the century of the animals. Are you really optimistic that animals are going to receive rights very soon?
I'm somewhat guardedly optimistic, although, you know, part of me says they have to. They absolutely have to, because we cannot continue screwing over this planet the way we have been and get away with it.
Yeah.
Because it obviously harms animals when we take away habitats and we hear about biodiversity loss and extinction rates and all that stuff. But this stuff will all come back and haunt us, because we're animals too, and we're dependent on this planet. And we can't just go live in bunkers. We need food. We need to have places to live. So unless we stop and say, look, we just can't continue depleting the planet of habitats and plants and animals, unless we do that, we're going to really pay a big price. And unfortunately, you know, it's our tendency to sort of make the mistakes before we come to our senses. And right now we're kind of in the continue to make the mistakes mode, even though we're beginning to come to our senses and realize there's a problem here. However, the positive side is once we get our act together, we can change very fast. And we've shown that time and time again in the past with social change, the abolition of the slave trade, the getting voting rights for women and the civil rights movement. I mean, really fundamental changes. So that's where my optimism comes in. The other part of it is really what choice is there to be optimistic. We have to make these changes. We have to believe we can do it. let's believe we can do it. Let's lay the groundwork and let's get going on it. So that's part of my optimism as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I was just watching a show on PBS on Orangutan Diaries, and it was talking a lot about all these orphan orangutans that they're rescuing, you know, due to the encroachment of palm oil groves on their forest habitats. And it's just heart-wrenching to look into the faces of those baby orangutans and know that there's really no habitat to reintroduce them into. Very little is left.
And that speaks to sort of the role that we all play in this. I mean, legislation is perhaps the most far-reaching and effective and powerful way to change things for the better. But by the same token, people have to be empowered with information, and they have to realize that what they go and buy at the supermarket or the drugstore may be affecting orangutans on the other side of the planet. And so consumer responsibility, which comes, of course, from consumer knowledge, is a vital part of that change. And so we have to create more activism and more empowerment in people to know that their decisions make a difference as well.
Well, and a good place to start is by reading your books. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about how they can find your books?
They can go to my website and order them from there, either through Amazon or through independent booksellers. Amazon.com, of course, is a place to order books at discount. Local bookstores, probably, you know, they don't carry books for too long unless they're bestsellers. And so they're probably not going to be in the bookstore, but you can always go to a bookstore and ask them to order a book, and they'll almost always do that.
Do you have another book in the works?
I do. I'm working on it today. It's going to be the first ever, as far as I know, the first ever book of fish advocacy. The Inner Lives of Fishes is my working title. That will probably change, but just essentially the science of our understanding of fishes and their cognition and their awareness and their sentience has advanced to the point that a very strong case can and should be made that we need a new relationship with fishes.
Oh,
well,
wow.
That sounds great. I love that book, that Your Inner Fish, or I don't know the exact title of it, but it's also a great book on the morphological similarities between fish and the evolutionary ladder. So we're looking forward to that book coming out soon.
Well, me too. It's a lot of work, but it's a labor of love, and I'm excited to be working on it.
We've been talking with Jonathan Balcom, a biologist, expert on animal behavior, and author of several books. And we really appreciate you being with us on the show today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
To learn more about the inner lives of animals, please visit Jonathan's website, which is jonathanbalcombe.com.
If you'd like to learn more about a compassionate diet and a vegetarian lifestyle, visit the website of the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click the Listen to Past Shows button. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
Hey, hey, hey. Hey, I wish you well, baby. Oh, I wish you well. Hey, hey, I wish you well in everything you do. I pray good things will come to you. I hope you find what you're looking for. Keep love in your heart, baby. Keep love in your heart. Hey, hey.
I wish you well.
Everywhere you go, take love with you, and it will show. Don't be too proud to say you're sorry, and love will take care of you.